and welcome back to the DF Retro Super Show. I'm John Lindemann, and today we have a special episode for you. We're talking about rail shooters, and specifically a new one coming out pretty soon called Wild Blue Skies from Chuhai Labs. We're actually joined by a special guest, but before we get to that first, I have my co-host and wingman for this one, Audie Surly, here with me.
Go out on town, John. Let's find some broads.
Okay, if you say so. And to join us on that random quest, we are joined by, from Chuhai Labs, Zach Aikman.
Hello, good to be here.
So why don't you fill in the audience real quick on your role, what you're doing there at the studio, and then we're going to talk about rail shooters and Wild Blue Skies itself.
Sure thing. So I'm Zach. I'm the technical director at Chuhai Labs. We're a Kyoto-based indie development studio led by veteran programmer Giles Goddard. And we make all kinds of stuff, but we're most excited about Wild Blue Skies, which is coming out next month.
So we're trying something a little bit different here by inviting a guest, somebody working on a retro-inspired game, and we're going to kind of talk about all that today and see how it goes. But as a reminder, of course, if you want to support the show, go over and check out digitalfoundry.net, check out the Patreon, all that good stuff. You'll find us over there, the retro tier. Since we're joined by our special guest today, I thought we're going to jump right into the action, Audie. So yeah. I think the path to this game and like the reason for this conversation is pretty clear. It feels like over the last few years, the rail shooter has become somewhat popular again. Maybe it's the rise of indie games and, you know, platforms like Steam making it possible to do these slightly smaller scale things. But even Nintendo got in it with the recent Star Fox 64 sort of pseudo remake, if you will. But obviously, Zach, the studio over at Chuhai Labs, you know, you've got Giles Goddard there. He was one of the guys involved in the original Star Fox. So there's like this deep connection back to the history of rail shooters. And it's kind of cool to see you guys finally tackling this topic for yourself. So like, what's the general vibe and feeling behind like revisiting like rail shooters as a whole and like basically stepping back into the genre that really helped Argonaut take off in the first place?
That's a great question. I think in a lot of ways it was almost how could we not do it? You know, it was almost an obligation to make something like that. But it was something that everyone in the studio was really excited to work on. And it's kind of our, you know, our love letter, our modern take on those classic 90s on rails adventures.
Yeah, and a lot of these things go way back to, like, I was kind of looking into this and trying to understand, like, where does this even begin? And I feel like it starts a little earlier, but it's stuff like Space Harrier, I think, in 1985 that really kind of begins this idea of, like, you're taking a shooter, right? Before you had vertical, horizontal shooters where you're basically, you know, moving across the screen, bullets are coming, you're dodging, you're shooting enemies. But something like Space Harriers, where they're like, hey, what if we do that in three dimensions? You know, where you're moving into the camera, into the world, being tracked in 3D space, sort of. And that stuff kind of like built up over years. I think Namco's Starblade was one of the big popular ones at the time. Did you like what kind of experience did you have back in the day with like rail shooters? Like, where did you actually come in? Because I think, you know, you're possibly a bit younger than us. So maybe not there at the beginnings, but, you know.
I turned 40 this year, if that...
All right, well, we're in the same ballpark so that...
In the same neighborhood? Okay, that's good. The first game I remember playing that was on rails like that, and, it, you know, very different than Space Harrier or Star Fox, was Rebel Assault with the FMV on rails sections.
Right.
And those were... I was actually went back before this interview and was watching a video just to prepare, like, refresh my memory, and those were really... dated, really rough, you know, like as on rails as it gets, because you have almost no control compared to what we have now, where, you know, at least there's some, you know, lateral motion, but also you can boost and you can brake and control that. So it's a genre that's come a long way. Sure.
Yeah, Audie, we have we've also played plenty of Rebel Assault, I believe, and both Rebel Assault 1 and 2. And
yeah, especially
it is 2. An interesting, yeah, especially 2, right?
Yeah.
And what they tried to do back then was like combine FMV with like more interactive bits, right? Because like if it's just too much FMV, then it becomes this essentially non-interactive thing. But they actually allowed some very limited camera motion by panning the video. You have like a cursor for aiming. They use like sprites and other objects for, you know, enemies and targets. And I think even in like Rebel Assault 2, they had like these like on foot sections where you're able to shift the whole scene.
That's right, yeah.
Left and right.
That was the big kind and of addition to that game.
Exactly. But I think Factor 5 was involved with Rebel Assault 2 on PlayStation. Yeah, is that
only
right?
On the PlayStation. So on PlayStation, Factor 5 took over, and they actually like created a lot of polygon models and kind of made it a little bit more 3D and interactive, because the original is pretty much all FMV outside of like some sprites for the interactive elements. But the PlayStation version is quite interesting because it's kind of like a remodeling of that genre. And I think as far as you can kind of take it under that like model of OnRail.
Exactly. And interestingly, it's funny, they would go on to do all those Star Wars 3D games, right? Like Rebels, or not Rebel Assault, but like Rogue Squadron series, which is the antithesis of a rail shooter in that it's a free roaming style game. Even though that sort of gameplay kind of found its way into Star Fox via Star Fox 64, and I guess technically Star Fox 2. But actually, so you've played enough Star Fox, right, Zach? Not necessarily. That's not necessarily like your favorite shooter. We'll talk about that in a second. But sure, like, yeah. Did you experience the original Star Fox back in the day? Where did you start with that series?
I did. Yeah, the original Star Fox for Super Nintendo was one that I played as a kid. I never had a Super Nintendo. My first console was, I think it was the Game Gear.
Oh, wow.
The N64. Okay. A while after that. But I played it at, you know, a daycare center or a friend's house. So enough to play the first couple of levels, but not enough to beat it since I didn't own it. But it does have a, you know, very nostalgic place in my heart.
And that was, I always thought Star Fox was an interesting time, because doing full 3D on a console like the Super NES was not that feasible, right? But like the Argonaut guys helped create that Super FX chip. But I think the miracle of Star Fox is that they developed a game that's very playable at extremely low frame rates. And I think this is where it deserves the most credit, right? Because like the game runs mostly around like 10 frames per second. It's very choppy, sometimes worse. Yet it's still somehow pretty playable.
To your point there, John, like the frame rate, if you view it today under the kind of John Lindman lens, certainly with your new prescription there, that game on the surface might seem unplayable, right? Like just too slow. But Nintendo really laid up the original Star Fox very specifically to that frame rate. Like all the enemy layouts, all the patterns, all that stuff kind of works. And if you look at something, when I grew up, I played like Guardian on the Amiga. That's the first Amiga mentioned this episode, by the way, just to, yeah. If you look at those games, they kind of got the aesthetic and they tried to also make it like fully 3D, but nothing's laid out in the way that makes it satisfying to play. That's where you see that, like, with that low frame rate and like the limitations of that on-rail design really pops out, sticks out. But Star Fox is just so perfectly laid out because they really looked at the limitations and brought out the most of it.
Exactly. And I think this is a really important point, Zach, and I'm curious how this is going to play out for Wild Blue Skies, because like,
does that run at 10 frames per second?
Does it have a 10 FPS mode? No. Oh, okay. You could always include that in there, like optional 10 FPS mode, you know. But I guess one of the key things that made Star Fox so interesting, as you noted there, Audie, is the fact that they put a lot of attention into enemy placement and enemy patterns, right? And a lot of other attempts at doing this 3D shooter, they didn't do that. And the games just aren't that fun. And when I covered Star Fox 64 sort of remake recently, one of the things that caught my eye is the fact that in that game they can now conceivably draw out as far as they need to with visuals in the environments, right? No more fog, etc. but they still spawn in the enemies or near the player as it did on N64, which is like basically suggesting that even with the hardware power, one still must be very careful with your enemy placement and the patterns that appear before the player, right? So that you retain the pacing of the level. So just being able to see out as far as possible doesn't mean that you can actually just draw enemies arbitrarily all over the place. It's not fun. So I'm actually kind of curious then, like, what, like, did you guys, like, how did you tackle this sort of like thinking problem design aspect to this sort of 3D shooter, but on a new, you know, much more modern technology?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, because we originally had much further draw distances than what's in the ship game. And that was a decision that we made. It was kind of controversial when we made it within the team, because it meant pulling in the draw distance and increasing the fog. But we found that it made a big difference in terms of readability and being able to have those enemy encounters happen more suddenly, more abruptly, and be more surprising. Because when the draw distance is really huge, you start looking off into the distance, you get distracted by things, you're looking past the point that we want the player to look at. And so we wound up bringing that in considerably. And I think it works, definitely works better on the gameplay perspective, but it also kind of harkens back to the feel of those games, you know, where that was a limitation physically on the hardware. So it's a bit of an homage to that as well, but we found that was just the right choice for the game.
That's awesome. And yeah, it does. It kind of follows the old mantra of like limitations breed creativity. Right. Mm-hmm. And that actually directly contributed to the design of the game. And I actually was thinking about this recently, because obviously, as I mentioned, rail shooters were kind of like a 3D continuation of like vertical or horizontal style shooters. Right. And in those games, the enemies, what enemies you can see are constrained by the screen boundaries because it's a two-dimensional image. Now, yes, you can go insane and pull a Taito and like drop three monitors into a cabinet for that ultra-wide Darius presentation. But even then, you're still ultimately constrained as to where the enemies can start drawing. But with 3D, that limitation's gone, and you could conceivably draw out as far as possible if you had the hardware to do it. So I'm glad that you guys are taking this into account. By the way, which is this a Unity-based game, or what are you running?
It is. Okay. Yes, it is.
As an aside, that's so. I did play the demo quite a bit, actually. I really liked what I've played, and it's very, very fluid. And I'm one of the things that I found with Unity games, and I'm glad you guys didn't fall into the trap, is that and I've talked about this before, is the way the camera system can work in Unity is that Unity defaults to a 50 hertz tick rate for its physics, right? And if you just attach the camera to an object that is governed by the physics engine, that causes the camera then to update at 50 hertz, even if the game's internal frame rate is much higher. This causes games to look very juddery in motion. And I cannot begin to tell you how many Unity games have shipped with this problem, and it is absolutely, like, it drives me insane. I basically cannot play it. So I was extremely relieved to find that Blue Sky, Wild Blue Skies, does not have this problem. So I'm curious then, like, how did you guys approach that to make sure that the game was extremely smooth? Is it interpolation, or do you actually adjust things like the physics tick rate? Like, what's your approach here?
So I think Unity gets a bad rep sometimes with indie developers, because it's so accessible, it's so easy to jump in and start making something in Unity. And if that's your first experience with game development, then you don't know exactly what it is you're looking for or what's going wrong. But myself and a lot of the people on the team come from a background of, you know, other game engines, or not necessarily AAA, but like game engines that were hand-rolled or written in C++. And so knowing how things are supposed to function means that you can fix those things in Unity. You know, we're not going under the hood and modifying source code to the engine or anything, but you can control the update rate for the camera and make sure that it updates properly after every other object is updated and things like that. So we're just very careful about making sure that was as smooth as it could be. And we spent quite a bit of time on the controls in the camera. Those are, you know, two of the most important parts of any on-rails shooter. So that was something we wanted to make sure we got feeling as good as possible.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. And Audie, I think we've thought about this a lot. It's like the camera is so important to a rail shooter, and not just like where it goes through the environment, but how it frames the ship. And this is something Star Fox always got right, even from the beginning, where you have the ability to move around the scene, but the camera only tracks so far in those different directions. And so, like, if you fly off to the upper left corner, the camera stops at a certain point. You actually see your ship kind of move up into the upper left corner of the screen. It's sort of framed from below. And it's a really, like, cinematic, beautiful-looking angle that it still retains visibility. Whereas some other shooters, like, you mentioned Guardian on Amiga, right? If you play Guardian, like, the ship is just like boom. So right in the middle of the screen, right in your sight, in your sight line.
Static, basically. It's just, so,
right? It just sits there in the middle. It's the worst possible position you could imagine for this.
It's funny just right? how many games during that time looked at Star Fox and aesthetically kind of saw, okay, you know, simple non-shaded polygons, and like that's kind of it. That was the allure of this game, is just that look. And no one kind of looked at the rest of the game design. But yeah, I mean, the linearity of a rail shooter means that, like, you take into account, like, it's like you say, cinematic, right? Because you're framing the action on a very linear path, which when you looked at, like, the Laserdisc games and stuff, they were making these FMV backgrounds, sometimes very noisy and whatnot, but the game, you know, you can extend the screen slightly based on the fact that it's just a video background. And these games were kind of the same, even though they're not generating videos. But nonetheless, you're trying to frame the action, and you're trying to get people on that path and structure kind of like a rhythmic kind of sense going through that stage to make it interesting and interactive and engaging. But so many of these games sound like The Guardian, and then there were so many others, even like on Jaguar, there was Cybermorph and stuff.
Of course.
And none of them.
Battlesphere.
Battlesphere, yeah. they just didn't get it. So even when you kind of expand that play field into fully 3D like those, and even Star Fox 2 to that extent, it really, even though it's not as linear anymore as a result, it is just so much more empty as a game.
Exactly.
Ironically.
Oh, I miss Battlesphere isn't like that. That's a first person game. I forget.
There's another Battlemorph.
That's the sequel to Cybermorph. Yeah. But you're right. Even on PC as well, there's an era of these sorts of games where the camera was not a consideration, and you just feel like they just drop you in that world with very poor sight lines.
Yeah.
Which is not fun.
And no one looked at the actual game design, it felt like, at that time.
Right. It was just, let's throw a bunch of stuff on screen, fly a ship around, and you just kind of like shoot at things. And it wasn't great. Yeah. But obviously, I mentioned Space Harrier was kind of one of the beginning points, but Sega continued with several others, first of which being Panzer Dragoon.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, Zach, did you ever actually get a chance to play any of Sega's Panzer Dragoon games? And what did you think?
I did not. I've seen videos of Panzer Dragoon, but I never got to play the actual title.
Oh man, you should absolutely give this a shot then in the future. Like, these are, I think, just top tier rail shooters that follow a philosophy similar to Star Fox, but they introduced a couple things that are interesting. And I'm wondering if you guys thought about this. So first of all, they did bring in the sort of like lock on targeting stuff. Star Fox 64 would do this too, but Panzer Dragoon did it before that.
Yeah.
Where you could essentially hold the fire button and like paint the screen and then let go, and you sort of blast everyone in the area. And obviously Wild Blue Skies does follow this sort of mold with a proper like lock on kind of system in addition to the normal shot. Right. So, which is cool. But one of the things that Panzer Dragoon did that is also common to a game I know you love, Zach, is they allow you to rotate the camera around the central object. So you tap L and R on the Saturn controller, or just keep rotating the cursor, you can actually see 360 degrees around your character.
Right.
and they send enemy patterns very specifically designed from different points. It's not like you're always getting attacked from all sides. It's like, oh no, at this part, now we've got enemies coming in from behind you. So you spin the camera around, you're dealing with foes coming at you. Sometimes you have them come from the side. Obviously the game I'm talking about here that you do love is Rez, which, so I want to talk about that in the sec, but I am curious, did you guys really like consider like what led to the decisions and the design for the types of camera system? Did you think about doing more full 3D camera stuff? Like, what was the kind of guiding principles in terms of how you wanted to make this as a rail shooter?
We did play around a little bit with, panning the camera, being able to, you know, kind of look around a bit within the general field of view of always moving forward. But we didn't ever really consider Panzer Dragoon style, you know, looking back over your shoulder, fighting enemies behind you. We did go through a couple of different iterations of camera and ship controls in the all range sections of the game, with a lot of kind of like quick turnarounds. And some of that is still in what we shipped, but it was never that, you know, that drastic of a departure from always looking down the corridor and shooting forward.
I guess
maybe for the sequel.
And I guess it kind of makes sense though, because like fundamentally, if you're controlling a ship, you're not going to be able to shoot in 360 degrees in a satisfying way. Whereas both Rez and Panzer Dragoon, there is a humanoid like figure that determines where you're firing, right? And that makes sense where you could aim in all directions. So, but obviously Rez, which was a Dreamcast PS2 era game, just an awesome attempt at fusing music and gameplay together. And I would actually argue though, and maybe Audie, I'm curious if you agree, I think Panzer Dragoon actually did this already, interestingly enough. Like, that was one of the key features, is that the soundtrack was specifically scored and designed to follow the levels.
Yeah.
So much so that the original Panzer Dragoon, if you try, there's like a hack in some of the later ports where you could run it at 30 FPS instead of 20.
And it goes,
and it actually breaks the sync
because
the music is composed for it, right?
Yep. Exactly. And that really heightens that, you know, I think that's what kind of brings Panzer Dragoon into a different realm, is just how it's even more so that cinematic angle, in the sense that the music is then scored and timed with the on-screen action, which really, it's why it kind of remains my favorite in the genre. So I was kind of, I didn't play Rez as much, honestly. I mean, I played it now in later years, but when it came out, I wasn't really that attached to it.
Yeah, for me, I did love Rez. I bought it day one, the US PlayStation 2 release, which is the 60 FPS version, whereas the Dreamcast one in Europe and Japan was only 30 FPS,
right,
which is a shame, but it's a beautiful game. And I think, Zach, you have a lot of experience with this one. And it's not so much like a challenge, and like, it's not designed to shoot you down. It's more about getting through it, getting those scores, and basically experiencing it, right?
100%. Yeah, that's the word for it. It's an experience rather than a challenge. It is challenging to get 100%
of every level,
see everything. It's tough, but you don't need to do that, and you can get through it and still feel like you did pretty well, even if you didn't shoot down every single thing.
The audio design in Rez is like insane for its time. Like, have you, Zach, I don't know how much you go back, but have you ever played, it's a Famicom Disk System game called Otoki.
No.
You should look that up. So it's a 2D music shooter on Famicom Disk System, but it kind of, I don't know, I think they've asked in interviews at some points, kind of like, was Otoki kind of involved in the inspiration for Rez? And I think the answer is no. But there are some similarities, and it's actually one of my favorite games on Famicom Disk System. But I'd be interested to see what you think now if you played it, because it is very interesting for the time it came out. It's like 86 or 87.
Okay,
yeah,
I will definitely go check that. That sounds like it's right up my alley.
Yeah, you introduced that to me as well, Audie. I definitely can see a lineage there, even if they weren't directly inspired by it or anything. You can see that people were thinking about this idea.
The idea was there. And, like, this is, you know, for Famicom Disk System, it was also one of the few games that kind of took into account the additional sound hardware that came with the disk system. So, yeah, it's an interesting game for many reasons. Otoki, I don't know if this is the episode to go into it, but had an interesting spokesperson attached as well. But yeah, that's a game that more people should be aware of.
Interesting. Yeah, I think we looked at that before, even on the channel.
Could
Famicom Disk System related video.
Yeah, I think the first video I ever did for the channel was in the FDS episode, wasn't it?
Possibly?
I was sitting there Darren Headlights talking about something.
I think we would have done Bubsy before that, but
maybe it was the same day.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
Somewhere around that time. But yeah, so man, just talking about all this, though, it really like sort of hits home just like the different flavors of rail shooters that were happening at the time. And I guess one of the ones that was only kind of like really officially uncovered recently in the last like decade was Star Fox 2. And I'm wondering if you guys, when developing this, like, was there any, like, look back or discussion around that game?
I can't say that there was, no.
Okay.
To be honest.
I'm not too surprised. Was Giles involved with that one as well, or had he moved on from there? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I want to say he was, but he might have already been moving on to the N64 stuff at that time.
Right. Yeah, because that, obviously, Star Fox 2 was a weird one because they attempted to evolve the formula by taking it away from just pure rail shooting and, like, having more, like, on-foot stuff and, like, moving around the environments in 3D. Some of the stuff would kind of appear in Star Fox 64, I suppose, but Star Fox 2 is pretty crazy ambitious, I think, for what the Super NES could do. Hmm. But with all these different inspirations, though, is there any specific game, I mean, that you guys took inspiration from? Is it primarily Star Fox, or like what was the goal in terms of like, this is the type of rail shooter we want to make?
I would say something that pays homage to our roots, to the studio's roots. No one particular game, but just kind of drawing on that as much as possible. I mean, we had, you know, Giles did quite a lot of feedback and assistance, like mentorship, I guess, maybe the word, on the initial controls and camera stuff. And then everything else we kind of built out on our own. It was almost like maybe sketching out, you know, your memory of what the game or what those games were like back then, but doing it in a more modern and progressive way.
And then what's your approach to like level design in this? So it seems like it has both the free, like the forward momentum levels, and then also sort of like the free movement levels.
We call those all range,
yes,
and corridor levels. I'm partial to the on rail, to the corridor levels,
yeah,
just because I like that style of it. But you know, we wanted to mix it up and have a bit of both, because dog fighting is fun too. It's fun to be able to fly around and, you know, have that freedom of expression and flight, and not just be constrained. Because we did a lot of work on the controls for free flight, including some better like braking and turnaround controls to make it, you know, not as drifty and not as constrained. And we wanted a place to exhibit those and show those. So
I am curious then, like, from a perspective of like when you're developing, you're working within the Unity engine, like, how do you handle the creation of these sort of like corridor levels? Like, obviously the map itself has to be built out. Is it like spawning in enemies based on player position, or is it like the camera position? Like, I'd be curious to learn more about that process.
Yeah, that was something that we went through a lot of iterations of. I mean, the whole game has gone through a lot of iterations. We started with a kind of a very different approach to what we wound up with, which was a lot more procedural and generative than what we wound up with in the end, which is much more handcrafted and fine-tuned. But we did have a system that would, you know, spawn chunks of content in front of you, like sections of the level. And so it was very dynamic. But again, we kind of, you know, fell back on a more hand-authored approach. But one thing that did remain pretty consistent was our tools for creating enemy waves and encounters. That was obviously a big, big part of the on-rails combat. And so that was something we spent a lot of time tweaking and getting right and having good controls where, you know, where you can scrub through an encounter and see when the enemies come in, and the patterns that they follow and things like that. So that was quite a lot of work, but I think it paid off in the end.
Oh, that's very cool. So there is like obviously a lot of manual adjustment here, which I think is key, because hand placement and like building these encounters out, I think is what makes these levels memorable. So, and it looks like the progression, from what I could tell, was that it actually follows a structure similar to Star Fox, where it's like path based, only it's like more of like an island map here as opposed to like a space chart, right? So you're moving to different areas within this space, but like depending on your performance in a level or your path chosen, it can determine essentially the course, right? Is that still kind of like the approach here?
100%, yeah. But not every level has branching paths, but there are several levels that have secret criteria, and if you complete those, then you unlock the hard path. And if you do that enough and stay on the hard path, then you get a different ending and a different final level at the end.
Cool. One of the things I really noticed from the demo playing it that I really liked is, we were talking earlier about the camera stuff, but like the way the ship interacts with the camera, specifically you have those like always visible contrails, like sort of spawning off the wings, and it creates this really cool effect where they don't distract, but it like gives the craft more momentum. And I'm curious about like the approach to like various effects like this. And if we're going to talk effects, also the rain in the demo level is freaking gorgeous, man. Like getting rain particles right is so hard, and a lot of games still don't do it, but man, it looks really good here.
Thanks. I'm really glad to hear that. We have a very talented team of artists. They're very, very good, especially at effects and shader style things. The contrails, the wingtip trails in particular, those underwent a lot of iteration as well, just to make sure they weren't too thick or didn't last too long, you know, because you want that impact, but you don't want it to get in the way of gameplay.
Exactly. So like with the rain particle effect, I am curious to ask about this. Is this something where the particles are spawned around you, like say like in a post-process volume kind of thing? Like if you're within this volume, it's rain? Or like, how is this actually drawn into the environment in this case?
Oh, it's been a while since I've looked at that level. I want to say that it travels with the player.
Okay, that's what I thought. That would make sense.
But don't quote me on that. Yeah, I'm excited for everyone to be able to see the other levels besides Hurricane, which is the one in the free demo, because we have some really, really cool looking levels and effects and just kind of like atmospheric settings for it. It's a really pretty game.
Yeah, and looking at the title, like I've seen some of the clips from the trailers, like it's wild blue skies, and the blue color used in the blue skies I think is actually quite awesome. And it does actually feel, I would say it does remind me of the famous Sega blue skies that we all kind of yearn for from the 90s, right? There's a very specific color to it that's just really, really striking.
Yeah, it's one of the prettiest games I've had the pleasure of working on, I would say.
So the demo, I guess, was available on PC, but this is also coming to consoles, I think.
It is, yeah.
What was your, so when building this out, like, what was your approach to the multi-platform development to ensure smooth performance? I assume that 60 FPS is the target across the board.
That's the target across the board. Yeah. All of our launch titles should be hitting that. Cause you know, smooth gameplay is important. Our focus was mostly on PC just for ease of use for everyone being able to play the game regularly. And we surprisingly didn't have that many issues with performance. We test it as regularly as we can. And of course, there's some stuff, you know, that sneaks in that you need to cut down, or you realize, oh, this shader is just way too complex for the console, so you have to rein it back a bit. It was fairly smooth overall getting it on console.
I did notice the PC demo did at least seem to support frame rates above 60 as well, which felt really great.
Great. I don't have a machine that supports that, but I'm glad that it did work for you.
That's actually that actually kind of brings me to a side topic on this, on the development side. And I hear this a lot from developers. Yeah. It's like when targeting certain higher spec features, right? Like I talked to a friend of mine working in another studio, and I was like, you guys should look at implementing some nice ray tracing features in this or doing something. And they're all like, yeah, we'd love to, but none of us have the hardware for it. Right. It's the same with like HDR implementations. I've seen a lot of studios with like, well, we put HDR in, and one game in particular, some folks I knew that worked on it, like the HDR wasn't great. And then I was like, so what did you guys build this from? And they were using some like, you know, dirt cheap LCD display that just happened to support HDR. And that was their only reference point. Right. And so like for smaller studios, it's amazing how, the hardware that's available to the people making the game can kind of place, you know, financial and experiential limits on what can be targeted. So like if you're building something out here that's going to support these ultra high frame rates, you yourself, I mean, I assume it's being tested somewhere, but you yourself can't actually even see it, right?
Yeah, and the same with things like with 4K, you know, it would have been great to do native support, like all the assets authored at 4K, but that's a lot for a team of our size. Same with ray tracing and HDR and all these other effects, because we're a fairly small team. You know, at any one point in the project, we've had about two and a half programmers on it. So it's a pretty, you know, you gotta put your energy where you're going to see the most results. And for us, that's always been focusing on the gameplay and on the visuals, but more on the, you know, the art of it rather than the visual fidelity or the fancy features.
I think that's the right move in this case anyway.
Especially for a game that, you know, is kind of echoing those 90s classic on-rail adventures.
Exactly. And speaking of style, then, there's these sort of animated scenes in there, and I'm curious about those. That's like a separate kind of thing. Like, do you guys work with like a special studio, or is this like all in-house animation? Like how was this achieved? Cause it looks awesome.
It looks great. I loved it. That was an external studio. We don't have the 2D
I can imagine.
On staff to do that. That's like an anime, you know, style quality. Yeah. But we're all really, really happy with the way the intro video turned out. I think that's kind of the only instance of that style of animation. But it's really good at setting the tone and introducing you to the characters and the world and kind of the feeling that we're going for.
So one of the things I talked about earlier then, of course, was the music stuff, right? You love Rez, you know, fans of Dragoon, it great, like, musical integration. What was the approach to audio for this one in terms of, like, the soundtrack and, like, was there any like attempts to sort of synchronize this stuff to the gameplay specifically, or is it more like backing tracks that sort of play along with each stage, which I guess is more like Star Fox?
There was discussion at one point of doing something a little more dynamic where we have, you know, stems that come in at certain points, but in the end we wound up just having you know, straight tracks that play for each level. And that was a lot of back and forth and just kind of nailing down how, not bombastic, but like grandiose we wanted things to be. But we were lucky to work with a really talented composer, Mark Junker, who turned out some really great songs for us. And we also even worked in a little bit, I'm not going to say where it is. I think it's better if people listen and try to find it, but a little bit of, N64 era, SFX into some of the tracks as well, some like signature sounds from certain games.
Oh no, okay, that's interesting. That's a fun idea, actually. So we actually haven't talked at all about Star Fox 64. I mean, I assume that was a game that you guys looked closely at during development, just in terms of like inspiration.
Yeah, and we're, you know, everyone's really excited about Star Fox 64 or Star Fox on the Switch 2. I haven't gotten to play it personally because I don't have a Switch 2 yet.
Oh, yeah.
That is one of the games I'm most looking forward to playing, that and the Ocarina of Time remake whenever that comes out.
Yeah, it's kind of and it's interesting to look at this, to that remake, to look at this, games like Zodiac EX, other rail shooters, and I realize they haven't evolved that much, and that's okay. Like, there's certain game genres where, like, this, I don't really necessarily want to or need them to be trying to push the boundaries forward at a certain point, because I think execution is more important than revolutionary design, right? Like, getting a tried and true thing down and nailing it. And I think about this a lot, actually. Like, when I think about platform games, for instance, they were everywhere, right? But there's not a lot of them that actually stand toe-to-toe with, like, the best of, from, like, Mario or, like, the Sonic games and the Genesis or something, where, like, I feel like they're so well-tuned and designed that rather than focusing on straight new ideas, I prefer when games attempt to take what's known and do it at the best possible quality. And I kind of feel like that is a driving principle behind this game, because it's a game that sort of follows tried and true paths, but the execution of it seems to be, like, the big focus here in terms of the getting everything to come together.
Yeah, there was, I can say there was a period of time in which we were going in a completely different direction that would have been maybe a bit off in left field for some fans of the series, but seeing how people have responded to Star Fox, the remake, and just the excitement for that kind of handcrafted, you know, cinematic adventure and experience is really encouraging, because that's where we settled in the end with Wild Blue Skies.
So that kind of reminds me of Carve. Were you involved with that? Carve snowboarding?
A bit. At the time, I was busy on a project we were doing for Universal Studios Japan. Cool. But I was kind of involved in it.
So that's an interesting one, because that took the sort of, like, 1080 snowboarding style design and tried to do things in VR, which then fundamentally kind of changes it to be something else. And I think it's cool. It's a neat thing, but it scratches an itch different from the original 1080, if you will. Whereas when I look at Wild Blue Skies, it feels like it's much more direct in terms of, like, bringing inspiration and feelings from those original games, like Star Fox, into a modern game. But that also made me wonder, was there ever a point, you say it's changed a lot, where there was, like, maybe we should do this in VR, or was that ever, like, something on the table, or was it just like, nah, we're not doing VR right now?
Yeah, I can't say that was ever a consideration for Wild Blue Skies. We've done a lot of VR as a studio, as 2i Labs, and before that. And it's great. You know, I like VR. I really appreciate what it, like, the uniqueness of that experience that it offers. There's some things you can only do in VR, right? That you just can't do in 2D. But it is tiring to work in VR, like, to develop in VR, because of the constant headset work you have to do and the eye strain and things like that. But it's also that the audience is not as large as it is for 2D stuff still. You know, like, there are people that are very into VR, and I'm also very into VR, but that we wanted to make something with this game in particular that was much more accessible and that anybody could play.
That's awesome. That makes sense. Yeah. And that kind of ties into what I said earlier about, like, not trying to rock the boat too much, find something that works and just dial it in and make it as good as possible. We actually saw that last year as well. I don't know if you had a chance to play this. I assume you're busy with development, so probably not, but M2 released Night Striker Gear, which was a spiritual follow-up basically to the original Night Striker from Taito, which was sort of their cyberpunk themed Space Harrier like game back in the day. It was an absolutely amazing game, but M2 really, I think actually they worked with who was working for them, the guy that directed, like, Ikaruga for Treasure, was also leading this project, and they really found a way to sort of bring back the Night Striker experience, but in a fresh new way. And that's kind of, like, I feel like this is occupying that same space you know, where it's like bringing back these ideas, but in a really polished, interesting new way, which I like. So for those listening, if you haven't checked out Night Striker Gear, definitely do that. It's super good.
I'm definitely going to do that. That and Otoki are two games on my must play list now.
Absolutely, man. But one of the things of Night Striker was that when you're in the air, you actually fly, a vehicle flies freely. But if you hit the ground, it's sort of like the wheels come out and now you're like driving along the floor. So it's like this transformation thing. And obviously Star Fox itself has a lot of this stuff, right? You had like the tank missions. There was some walker stuff in certain installations. I don't know, obviously, because we haven't seen it. Like, does Wild Blue Skies stick with just the flight vehicles, or did you explore other types of vehicles as well?
Just flight.
Okay. I'm okay with that, for the record. I think I was just curious if that was an approach, because I think not everybody loves the non-flight levels in Star Fox 64, to be honest.
I think that considering how much time and experimentation and iteration we put into the flight controls and the camera, that doing that again for another vehicle that was like ground based would have been a lot to do, and it'd be better not to half ass it, to give it the same care and love that we put into the flight.
Have you talked about kind of setting up this or joining the studio and like the makeup of it?
Oh, yeah. I would like to know more about the history of that, how you get involved and sort of like the background there.
Yeah.
Sure. My
particular yeah, yours first.
At least. Both. Specifically. But yours first.
Yeah. Sure. So I live in Kyoto where the studio is based. And this actually comes full circle because I came to Kyoto 2011 for a few months, and I worked briefly at Q Games, run by Dylan Cuthbert, who also worked on Star Fox. I was there for a few months on kind of a work sabbatical. I went back to Seattle where I was living, and the week after I moved back to Seattle, I was at a Seattle Indies developer meetup, and I met this guy, Jake Kasdahl, who was one of maybe the only foreigner who worked on Rez, and we got to talking, and I mentioned that Rez was inspiration for me. It was one of the main inspirations for a student game I worked on that wound up winning the Independent Games Festival a while back. And so we got to talking about Rez, and he said, I'm looking for a programmer who wants to move with our studio from Seattle to Kyoto. And I was like, I just got back from Kyoto. And I'd love to go back. So I started working with Jake at 17-bit on Galaxy, space shooter game. And then we moved. We just, packed up the studio and moved from Seattle to Kyoto. And I stayed with them for another 4 or 5 years. And then I jumped ship to join Giles at what was then called Vitae Backroom. That company still exists, but we kind of rebranded ourselves as Chuhai Labs. Vitae. This is where we get into the studio makeup. Vitae Backroom has historically done a lot of contract work and external work. We partnered with Universal Studios and other companies like that. But Chuhai Labs is all about our own games. So starting with Curse to Golf and Carve Snowboarding and now Wild Blue Skies and then some Playdate titles as well.
Oh, yeah.
Those are all things that we've, they're more like our own authentic games rather than work we're doing.
Is it mostly expats there then?
Yes, mostly.
Oh man, actually that reminds me of the Playdate. Whitewater Wipeout. Yeah. So you actually have experience with working on the Playdate then?
We do. Yeah, we did two titles. We did Whitewater Wipeout, which was a launch title. I think it was the first game that appears.
Which was
cool. And then we also did Carve Junior, which is a Playdate follow-up to Carve Snowboarding.
So I love the Playdate. I actually have one sitting over there. I've played those games. I think it's a super cool little thing. And as kind of an aside, I'd actually like to hear your thoughts on working on it, because I haven't spoken with many people that actually developed for it, right?
Yeah. It is a tremendously fun little device to make games for. It really is. It uses Lua for the back end, or for the scripting language. But you can also dive into C to write code yourself, which is way more performant if you want to do stuff like that. We did some experimentations. Giles at one point had a little demo running of like a 3D wireframe on Rails shooter where you use the crank to go from a top-down view into a behind, like over-the-shoulder view. And that was really cool, but we didn't ever do anything with that.
Man, one of the weird, so Carve Jr. was interesting because the play date, I think it's either, is it a 1-bit screen or a 2, basically it's like black and white.
Yeah. Yep. Black and white.
That's yep. it. That's and it. So all shading has to be done with like dithering essentially. But something like Carve, yeah. it's like you're in an isometric view of a mountain, snow, which is all yeah. white. And like it's interesting, like it has this like kind of like dot pseudo dot dithery pattern on it. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, like what was that experience like in terms of like dialing in the best way to display something with just essentially black and white and making it actually look good?
Again, just a lot of experimentation and having really talented artists on the team.
They did a good job.
They did a great job. I was really happy with. I remember when I first saw the, you know, some of the sprites that were being made for it. I was like, "Wow, that looks really good for black and white, you know, 1D sprites."
It kind of reminds me. I think Audie might be able to attest to this. It reminds me a lot of the graphics techniques you used back on like the PC-88.
Yeah, yeah.
Back in the '80s, where it's like they were doing high res rendering back then, but with very very few colors. So a lot of games had to rely on like extremely heavy dither patterns.
Yeah.
But I almost feel like that itself is like a unique art form that produces a type of visual design that's very specific.
Fully agree.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of constraints. I think that's the one thing I wish there was more of, you know, because we're not, most games, especially at smaller studios like our size, we're not pushing up against the limitations of the hardware, which is what, you know, one of the reasons we talked about this earlier that made Star Fox, you know, so unique was that was why the draw distance was so low. And the play date brings us closer to that because there are limitations. You know, there's only so many things you can do. There's only two colors. And those kinds of restrictions always really make for interesting, unique kinds of games. And I think that there should be more of that.
Yeah. There's like Pico 8 and stuff, but I think Playdate is a really good example. Yeah, you kind of have to enforce like artificial limitation now. In order, like John and I went through this when we worked on our Zet, that like we kind of had to create our own little space where like limitations were set by us within like the framework of a pseudo like 32-bit engine. But it really does. It is really fun to kind of limit yourself in order to fully expand on your creativity. It really is a lost art form these days.
Maybe we could see Wild Blue Skies Jr. in the future.
That's the next project.
It's not out of the question.
So I do have another question about the Playdate hardware that I've always wondered about. It's one of the biggest limitations. I like what it does, but it seems like almost no games are able to scroll the screen at what I would say is a typical frame rate for side scrolling stuff of like around 60 Hertz or whatever. Like scrolling in general on the Playdate isn't that smooth. And I'm wondering if you have any insight into like what is bottlenecking the hardware? Like what are the limitations that prevent this from seemingly being possible within that specific platform?
So I'm not sure that there aren't any games that do that. I honestly haven't been back to check out the catalog.
There might be some exactly.
Stuff. Yeah, I feel like there might be some in the same way that like I, you know, when I was in junior high and in middle school, high school too, the TI-80X calculators, I would like write basic programs.
Dude,
on there, right?
I used to do that too. Yeah,
basic language was.
That was right? So fun.
And you could do some visual stuff and you could do graphics, but it was very choppy and slow. But then you'd find people who made like space shooters written in assembly that ran buttery smooth, right? And so I think I'm sure by now there probably are some people that have done some stuff in C, because it would almost definitely have to be in C to get that kind of frame rate. And I think even the demo I mentioned earlier with the over the shoulder top down shooter prototype, I think that was running pretty smoothly, you know, not like 60 FPS maybe, but
that's awesome. Actually, I love that reference to the old TI-82-83 era. I was also like really into that, and I did do some assembly work on that. It's the first time I ever tackled that, because I too was like, how is this possible? Why is this so smooth? Like, I don't understand. Because before that, I wrote like tried to make like a maze style game, but it was like networked, and by networked I mean we had this cable that you could connect from one to another person's TI-83.
The TI-Link
cable, where you actually do like pretty janky multiplayer stuff with it. But I did it by like I made the play field by just drawing an image first, because if you tried to draw it in real time while doing basic, it was like slow, but
impossible.
But you could move objects around at an okay speed and draw lines and stuff. But then once you get into the assembly stuff, it's like, oh wow. And that CPU is pretty simple, so it wasn't like super daunting. I guess it's kind of like Game Boy in that regard, where like the number of instructions you need to learn is low enough where I feel like you can sort of keep in your head like what's possible. Whereas like, I'd imagine, I have not even thought about it, but trying to do that kind of low-level assembly work on like a modern CPU seems like an insane thing that I can't imagine anybody wanting to do. But
the thing about the link cable reminds me of something I wanted to make or try doing on the Playdate, but just never had the time to do. You know, so there's Wi-Fi on the Playdate, so you can access the store and download updates and stuff, but there's no like way to connect to another Playdate and do any kind of multiplayer, online multiplayer. But it does have a audio jack, and I think there's also a microphone jack. And I wondered if you could have an audio cable linked between two Playdates and then have some code that, you know, basically like what a modem does, where you write and read audio signals to transmit data from one Playdate to another to get some like network play going. I thought that'd be really cool. But I've never met anyone who has a Playdate out in the wild. So I think it'd be fairly limited, you know, use case, maybe like 10 people.
I know. You're right though. That line of thinking though is awesome, because that's very much in line with like old style design, right?
Very much so.
Thinking outside the box, like what can we do with this hardware that's maybe it's not designed to do?
I love that stuff.
Oh man.
This is a random question, but like what was the first kind of coding language we all used for our first, like all the way back? Like what was the first language we used to create the game? Do we all remember? For me, it was BASIC.
BASIC.
Yeah, it was just BASIC. I was creating text adventures. And then there was the game, I forget what the name was, but on Commodore, there was a shooter game kit that was from Sensible Software, I think. So I started making shooters with that. But that was like a game kit thingy. But yeah, BASIC would have been the first thing I wrote out anything in.
I remember being excited about Duke Nukem 3D came with the build map editor.
I remember this.
And I didn't really have internet before that, so it was like the first time you could actually just like start building levels for it, right? Like for Doom, you would have to download something, but like Duke had it on the disc.
Yeah.
So even if you weren't connected, it's like, oh, here's this tool, you can actually make stuff. So I think my first thing I did there was like I tried to recreate Doom E1M1 in the build engine, as you do. It's like making, you know, Super Mario Brothers 1-1 in a side-scrolling game. It's like, I'll just try to recreate Doom, but I remember getting the scale wrong, so like it was kind of like that, but everything was like way bigger than it should have been. But hey, good times. What about you, Zach? Was it also BASIC, or did you start somewhere else?
No, it was QBASIC. I think it was the first language I used, and I do remember maybe I picked up from the library finding a book about the BBC Micro that had some code in there, but I didn't have a Micro. I had a Windows, you know, MS-DOS PC, and I remember opening up Notepad and Windows 3.1 and like, you know, copying in code from the book. So it was like, you can copy this code and run it, and then closing the file and opening it again and not not really understanding why the code I put in didn't do anything. And that was my first.
That is something that.
How does this work?
Like, this is something that kids today would not understand. But I remember buying magazines where, you know, for PC and Commodore, where they were printing out code, like source code. So you would sit there and those codes could be up to like 10 pages long, man. You'd just be flicking pages and like,
oh yeah.
And you made one mistake, right? And just like, you had no idea where you typed it's in over. That mistake. It was awful. But at the same time, I have a lot of reverence for that time. Like sitting there meticulously typing out and then seeing like the worst Maze game, probably John's Maze game from that calculator show up on my device. Just like, why did I do this? It took me 1.5 hours. But somehow I still thought that was fun.
I don't know if I'm the only one here, but have any of you written a game in COBOL?
No.
Not a game. I did it. But I did. Yeah,
when
correct.
Kind of when I was in college, you know, we had multiple COBOL classes, and a friend and I spent some time. We did like a little, because I was a big fan of like adventure games as well. So did like a text adventure in COBOL, and it's like the least efficient language you could ever imagine for something like that.
Yeah, I was gonna say that like doesn't seem very beneficial to you, but okay.
No, it was just a. Work in COBOL because I had to do it for school, but I hated writing COBOL because everything was so long. It was like 40, 50, 60 pages of printed out code just for something not that complicated. And you're just like, oh.
I remember you remember Age of Empires, right? When that came out, you could create these scenarios. So I just remember that at the time I had a group of friends, Tom being one of them, that John knows, mutual friend of ours. And we played a game, a board game or pen and paper game called HeroQuest, which was really popular here. I think most people know HeroQuest. We were really into it. But I was trying to expand it. So if we sat and played HeroQuest in pen and paper, there were scenarios where we had to jump over and play my Age of Empires map, because that was the expanded kind of feature in this complicated cobbled together mess. And then from there I also kind of set up a section that for some reason we use Super Probotector for it, which seems completely asinine because it's completely different art style and everything. But you had like these three games through different medias that you had to use, and I don't think it was very fun to play, but it was just like trying to expand this idea of how do we engage with these different games? That's why I'm not doing game design anymore, is these ideas.
It is interesting, though, you know, to tie it all back, I feel like this is the exact background that the original guys at Argonaut kind of came from, right? They're just a bit older, so they were at a point where they could immediately apply that to the industry. But it's a sort of like that 80s, 90s bedroom coding kind of thing, right? Just like trying to create like something cool. Because you look at that stuff, and you're like, this just feels like guys saying like, let's try to do something cool in 3D or something. You know what I mean?
Well, they did X on Game Boy, right?
Yeah, exactly. Which is exactly in line with this, right? Yeah, it's like, what if we made this hardware that is absolutely never, ever designed to do 3D stuff and do a 3D game in it? Like, that sounds insane, but that's exactly the kind of spirit that people had back then.
Hard driving was on Game Boy as well, right?
I think so.
Yeah, kind of similar type of thinking.
I think that was just like they would essentially string together like pre-drawn imagery to make it look like 3D or something, or it's not actually like doing any math on the polygons or anything. If I recall, it might have been something like that on the Game Boy. X, on the other hand, I think is actually, it's like more wireframey, but it's like, it actually is like real, like 3D, just very primitive.
But
super, super cool nonetheless. But here we are. I mean, it's obviously it's come a long way, and I think it's really cool that we have this new sort of like homage to the classic rail shooter genres with Wild Blue Skies. So when is this coming out, by the way?
August 13th.
Oh, that's soon. Man.
Almost exactly 1 month.
So it's almost out.
Very soon.
Well, okay, I'm super interested to give it a shot then.
Yeah, we have to kind of give this a proper shot when it comes out then and remind our audience, because that's... I really love the use of color in this game.
Yes.
Like, just the sublime art direction.
As I mentioned earlier, it really has what I always say is the Sega blue skies. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just this, it's a perfect vibe, and it's here. So I love that about it.
There's a couple of skyboxes in the game that are just the most beautiful combinations of orange and blue and purple. And every time I see it, I'm like, oh, fall in love with it all over again. So pretty.
That's so awesome.
I can say that because I didn't do any of the art. Yeah, we had a really, really talented team of people.
For sure, for sure. I love it. I think it's going to do it for this one, though. So I don't want to keep you too long here, but thanks for coming on and chatting with us, Zach.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a great time. I had a lot of fun.
And, of course, Audie joining me here at 10 a.m. German time.
Yeah, anytime. I mean, German time is my time, so.
Oh, yeah. And thank you. If you made it this far into the episode, we appreciate you listening as always. And hopefully you enjoyed this sort of, like, slightly different take on the episode. And we'd like to do more and invite more developers in the future to chat about their stuff, both from the past and present. And that's going to do it for now. So thank you for watching, and we'll see you next time.